The political power of his theory was that it forcefully and clearly confirmed the negative stereotypes of Democrats that Republicans had been working to embed in the nation's consciousness since 1968. Nixon had done it. Reagan had done it. George Bush had done it, too, when he turned the 1988 election into a referendum on Willie Horton and the Pledge of Allegiance. Now Newt had taken the art of reverse plastic surgery to a whole new level of sophistication and harshness. The problem with his theory was that it didn't fit the facts. Most Democrats were tough on crime, supported welfare reform and a strong national defense, and had been much more fiscally responsible than the new right Republicans. Most were also hard-working, law-abiding Americans who loved their country, worked in their communities, and tried to raise their children well. Never mind the facts. Gingrich had his storyline down pat, and he applied it every chance he got. I kept waiting for Gingrich to explain how the Democrats' moral bankruptcy had corrupted the Nixon and Reagan administrations and led to the crimes of Watergate and Iran-Contra. I'm sure he could have found a way. When he was on a roll, Newt was hard to stop. I spent much of the first 2.5 weeks of April meeting with world leaders. Prime Minister John Major, President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, and two intelligent, very modern women leaders of Muslim countries, Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto of Pakistan and Prime Minister Tansu Çiller of Turkey, all came to see me. Meanwhile, Newt Gingrich gave a speech on his first 100 days as Speaker. To hear him tell it, you would think the Republicans had revolutionized America overnight, and in the process changed our form of government to a parliamentary system under which he, as Prime Minister, set the course for domestic policy, while I, as President, was restricted to handling foreign affairs. For the moment, the Republicans were dominating the news, based on the novelty of their control of Congress and their assertions that they were making big changes. Actually, they had enacted only 3 relatively minor parts of their contract, all of which I supported. The hard decisions were still ahead of them. In a speech to the American Society of Newspaper Editors, I spelled out the parts of the contract I agreed with or on which I would seek compromise, and those I opposed and would veto unless the Republicans changed their policy. On April 14, 1995, I quietly filed for re-election, 4 days after Senator Dole announced his candidacy for president. On the 18th, I held a press conference and was asked more than 20 questions about a wide variety of topics, foreign and domestic. The next day, they would all be forgotten, and there would only be 2 words on the lips of every American: Oklahoma City. In late morning, I learned that a truck bomb had exploded outside the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, leaving the building a rubble and killing an unknown number of people. I immediately declared a state of emergency and sent an investigative team to the site. When the magnitude of the recovery effort became apparent, firefighters and other emergency workers came from all over the country to help Oklahoma City dig through the rubble in a desperate attempt to find survivors. America was riveted and heartbroken by the tragedy. It claimed the lives of 168 people, including 19 children who were in the building's daycare center when the bomb exploded. Most of the dead were federal employees who worked for the several agencies that had offices in the Murrah Building. Many people assumed that Islamic militants were responsible, but I cautioned against jumping to conclusions about the perpetrator's identity. Soon after the bombing, Oklahoma lawmen arrested and charged Timothy McVeigh, an alienated military veteran who had come to hate the federal government. On Sunday, Hillary and I flew to Oklahoma City for a memorial service at the Oklahoma State Fairgrounds. In moving remarks, Governor Frank Keating said that if anyone thought America had lost the capacity for love and caring and courage, they should come to Oklahoma. I tried to speak for the nation in saying, "You have lost too much, but you have not lost everything, and you have certainly not lost America. For we will stand with you for as many tomorrows as it takes." At the end of the first week of June, I vetoed my first bill, the $16 billion GOP rescission package, because it cut too much out of education, national service, and the environment, while leaving untouched unnecessary highway demonstration projects, courthouses, and other federal buildings that were pet projects of Republican members. They may have hated government in general, but like most incumbents, they still wanted to spend themselves to re-election. I offered to work with the Republicans to cut even more spending, but said it would have to come out of pork barrel projects and other non-essential spending, not investments in our children and our future. On June the 13th, in a nationally televised address from the Oval Office, I offered a plan to balance the budget in 10 years. The Republicans had proposed to do it in 7, with big spending cuts in education, health care, and the environment, and large tax cuts. By contrast, my plan had no cuts in education, health services for the elderly, the family supports necessary to make welfare reform work, or essential environmental protections. It restricted tax cuts to middle-income people, with an emphasis on helping Americans pay for the rapidly rising costs of a college education. Also, by taking 10 years instead of 7 to get to balance, my plan's annual contractionary impact would be less, reducing the risk of slowing economic growth. My budget decision was supported by Chief of Staff Leon Panetta, most of the economic team, the Democratic deficit hawks in Congress, and Dick Morris, who'd done polling in my governor's races and had been advising me again since the 94 elections. Most of the staff didn't like Dick because he was difficult to deal with, liked to go around established White House procedures, and had worked for Republicans. But I had worked with him long enough to know when to accept and when to reject his advice. Dick's main advice was that I had to practice the politics of triangulation, bridging the divide between Republicans and Democrats and taking the best ideas of both. To many liberals and some in the press corps, triangulation was compromise without conviction, a cynical ploy to win re-election. Actually, it was just another way of articulating what I had done as governor and with the DLC, and what I had campaigned on in 1992. I had always tried to synthesize new ideas and traditional values, and to change government policies as conditions changed. I wasn't splitting the difference between liberals and conservatives. Instead, I was trying to build a new consensus. And, as the coming showdown with the Republicans over the budget would show, my approach was far from lacking in conviction. On June the 29th, I finally reached an agreement with the Republicans on the rescission bill, once they restored more than $700 million for education, AmeriCorps, and our Safe Drinking Water program. Senator Mark Hatfield, the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee and an old-fashioned progressive Republican, had worked closely with the White House to make the compromise possible. In August, as we worked with the UN and NATO to thwart new Serb aggression, I continued to argue with the Republicans on the budget, noted that 1 million Americans had lost their health insurance in the year since the failure of health care reform, and took executive action to limit the advertising, promotion, distribution, and marketing of cigarettes to teenagers. The Food and Drug Administration had just completed a 14-month study confirming that cigarettes were addictive, harmful, and aggressively marketed to teenagers whose smoking rates were on the rise. August was a big month in the world of Whitewater, too. Kenneth Starr indicted Jim and Susan McDougal and Governor Jim Guy Tucker on charges unrelated to Whitewater, and the Senate and House Republicans held hearings all month. By this time, I had settled into a routine of handling press questions about Whitewater with as little public comment as possible. I'd learned from the press coverage over Gaze in the military that if I gave a meaty answer to a question on whatever the press was obsessing about, it would be on the evening news, blocking out whatever else I was doing in the public interest that day. And the American people would think I was spending all my time defending myself instead of working for them, when in fact Whitewater took up very little of my own time. So on a scale of 1 to 10, a 7 answer on the economy was better than a 10 answer on Whitewater. With the help of constant reminders from my staff, I held my tongue on most days. But it was hard. I had always hated abuse of power. And as false charges flew and evidence of our innocence was ignored, I was seething inside. No one can be as angry as I was without doing himself harm. It took me too long to figure that out. The fiscal year ended on September 30th, and we still didn't have a budget. When I wasn't working on Bosnia and the Middle East, I had spent the entire month traveling the country, campaigning against the Republicans' proposed cuts in Medicare and Medicaid, the Direct Student Loan Program, AmeriCorps, environmental enforcement, and the initiative to put 100,000 new police officers on the street. They were even proposing to cut back on the earned income tax credit, raising taxes on lower-income working families, at the same time they were trying to cut taxes for the wealthiest Americans. At virtually every stop, I pointed out that our fight was not about whether to balance the budget and reduce the burden of unnecessary government, but how to do it. The big dispute involved what responsibilities the federal government should assume for the common good.